morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Norman Black, and I'm a vice president with the Hatcher Group in Bethesda, today assisting the Center for Civil Rights Remedies with its release of some very important research in the arena of discipline disparities within our public schools. I'd like to start by briefly introducing the speakers that you'll hear today. I'll come back to Dan Lowson in just a second, so let me start with Congressman Bobby Scott. Representative Scott is serving his 12th term in Congress, representing Virginia's 3rd District. In the 114th Congress, Congressman Scott serves as the ranking member of the Committee on Education and the Workforce. In that capacity, as the most senior Democrat on the committee, he is leading the fight for access to a quality education for all of America's children, with an emphasis on solving the growing problems of student debt, closing the achievement gap, and dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline. Next, let me introduce Janelle George. Janelle is the Senior Education Policy Counsel at the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund, where she uses legislative and policy advocacy to promote racial justice and equal opportunity. She works with a broad coalition of stakeholders within coalitions and different campaigns to eliminate racial disparities and promote equitable school policies and practices. Prior to joining LDF, Ms. George served for half a decade as a legislative counsel and legislative assistant on Capitol Hill. Next, I'd like to introduce Diane Smith Howard. Diane is a senior staff attorney with the National Disability Rights Network. A litigator with 20 years of experience in juvenile and education law, Diane's work at NDRN focuses on conditions for youth in the juvenile justice system and child welfare system. In addition, she works on issues related to adults with disabilities in the criminal justice system and children and youth with disabilities that impact behavior in the public education system. And so now let me introduce Dan Lowson. Dan is the director of the Center for Civil Rights Remedies, an initiative of UCLA's Civil Rights Project that was launched in 2011 to focus on the issues of the school-to-prison pipeline and racial inequities in special education. Dan actually has worked at the Civil Rights Project since 1999, when it was affiliated with the Harvard Law School, where he was a lecturer. Before becoming a lawyer, Dan taught in public schools for 10 years, including work at one point as a founder of an alternative public school. Dan's work now focuses on the impact of law and policy on children of color and English learners in the public schools, with a view toward improving educational opportunities and outcomes, particularly in the area of school discipline. For the past 6 months, Dan and his colleagues have been exhaustively researching the latest discipline data filed by the nation's school districts with the federal government. In the process, making that data accessible and transparent in a way that's never been seen before. It is that report that we're here to discuss today. So without any further delay, let me turn the press conference over to Dan Lowson. Dan?
Thank you, Norman, and thank you all for joining this call today and expressing interest in covering this new report, Are We Closing the School Discipline Gap? And this is, we feel, very, very important for many reasons. One is that this report looks at the number of students suspended at least one time, and there were 3.5 million students suspended at least once in 2011 and 12. That equates to 18 million or more days of lost instruction in just 1 year. And that is one of the reasons, one of the overarching arguments we make in this report is that if we're going to close the achievement gap, we can't ignore this huge discipline gap, and the excessive discipline needs addressing. Excessive discipline needs to be part of the mainstream education reform efforts. It also, this report comes on the heels of our new book called Closing the School Discipline Gap, which demonstrates that there are, in fact, clear and effective remedies to help reduce suspensions and reduce racial disparities and that improve educational outcomes. So it's really important to keep in mind that we're talking about excessive suspensions. Most of these are for minor offenses, and improving academic outcomes, and that these two things go hand in hand. But we can't fix what we don't talk about. And so this report, which covers every single district in the nation, provides a benchmark for analyzing progress and also identifying problems, but also for finding what is working and monitoring efforts to improve school climate. one of the things that's important to note is that the data, the national data, are collected every other year. So one of the things that we think is critically important is that we start collecting and analyzing these data from every district every year, disaggregated and publicly reported data. It's also critically important to look at the elementary school data separate from the secondary level, and secondary level includes all the middle schools and high schools. Otherwise, some of the worst situations are obscured. So, for example, you'll see in the first table, figure one, shows you the different suspension rates. So for all kids at the elementary level, it's about just over 2.5% of all elementary school kids were enrolled were suspended at least once. And that number jumps at the secondary level to over 10%. So that's a huge difference right there. And we find that when you break it down by race and ethnicity and English learners and kids with disabilities, sometimes the suspension rate is 2, 3, or even more times higher at the secondary level. So it's really important to break those two apart. If you just look at K through 12, it mitigates some of these extremes that we're noticing. We break up the report into two parts, elementary schools and secondary schools. And one of the things that you'll see on page 15, figure 6, is that we show you the distribution for each racial group for the suspension rate at the elementary level for districts across the country. But on page 18 in table 4, you see some of the worst and highest suspending school districts, and you'll see that several of the districts we looked at, some of the highest suspending ones, were suspending over 20% of their enrolled elementary school students. So that's more than one out of every five elementary school students in some districts were suspended out of school at least one time. And we were surprised to see that three of these very high suspending large districts were in the St. Louis metropolitan area. And they include the district where reportedly Michael Brown once attended school, which was Normandy. So these you see on page 18. We also note that Missouri, at the elementary level, had the highest black suspension rate and the highest difference between the suspension rate of black students and white students. So it was 14% across the state of black elementary school students suspended at least one time, and less than 2% of the white students, for a gap of 12.5 points. That means that black students, 12.5 more black students per 100 were suspended out of school than for white students. Now, at the secondary level, we found that there were some districts, we found some very high rates as well, but we also found, including some of the districts with high rates, had made great strides, and we highlight these on page 28 of the report. And some of these that made some of the largest declines include Fort Wayne, Indiana, where suspension rates at the secondary level went from 37% of the enrolled to 22%, or Henrico, Virginia, 31% to 14%, Worcester, Massachusetts, suspension rate of 37% is now down to 16%. So this is just in a two-year period. Visalia, California went from 41% to 16%. So this is really important to highlight that even though some of these districts still have what we would consider unacceptably high suspension rates, they've made tremendous progress in just a two-year period. And it really suggests that this is possible for all districts. In fact, there were 283 districts that reduced their overall suspension rates by 10 points or more in just 2 years. Now, some of the districts with extremely high and disturbing disparate rates at the secondary level also were at the elementary level, including some of the ones in Missouri. But some of the secondary suspension rates that really shocked the conscience were Chokia, Illinois, with 62%. Of all the enrolled students were suspended out of school. Greenville, Mississippi, You can see these on page 27 of the report. Oklahoma City, 45% of all the students enrolled. And in many of these high suspending districts, we see that students with disabilities are among the highest suspended, with suspension rates of 60, 70, 80%. And also black males are typically among the very highest of the high. And this just, again, it should shock our conscience, and it should prompt action. But it's also important, and the reason that is also so shocking is that, and why we should have to reject the status quo, is that there's a huge range in suspension rates. There are huge differences from one state to the next, from one district to the next, and even within many of these districts. So racial disparities are a huge problem at the secondary level. Some of the state, we ranked all the states. On page 23 at the secondary level, you can see the state rankings. Florida, for example, across the state for all kids suspended almost 1 in 5, 19%, and that was the highest suspending state for both elementary and secondary level. In Rhode Island, 1 in 5 Latinos and American Indians, tied with North Carolina and South Dakota for high suspension rates. In Wisconsin, more than 1 in 3 black secondary students across the entire state, while only 1 in 4 white students were suspended. So we see these incredibly high suspension rates. And again, students with disabilities in Florida at the secondary level, 37% across the entire state were suspended at least once. We also found an unusual trend in that for English learners in the states of Arizona, Massachusetts, and California, these are three states that had the English-only, have English-only requirements, had much higher than average suspension rates for English learners. And in Montana, almost 1 in 5 elementary students were suspended out of school. But the true, a lot of the important findings are at the district level. And that's where you see even, the most profound racial disparities. We also, though, again, looked at the number of high suspending and low suspending schools. And in that analysis, we provide that nationally and for every state in the report. And so at the secondary level, for example, we found that we defined a high suspending school if any major racial or ethnic group, if 1 out of 4, 25%, of any major racial ethnic group was suspended out of school, we consider that high suspending at the secondary level. And what we found was disturbing, that 24% of all secondary schools in the nation met that definition. On the other hand, 38% met the definition of a lower suspending, where 10% or less of every single major racial and ethnic group was suspended out of school. So in other words, there were actually more lower end suspending schools than at the higher end, which tells you, again, that we can reject the status quo, not just based on academic studies or isolated studies of individual districts, but because we see that there are low suspending or lower suspending schools and districts found across the nation, and they actually outnumber the ones at the very high end of the spectrum. So this wide range of support is really important from a civil rights perspective, because part of the question is, are there less discriminatory alternatives? Is there another way? And in fact, there are, and schools and districts across the country are doing things differently. And so we really need to find out why they are being successful and use those examples to inform what's going on in these schools that are just off the charts. And also it's important that the public has a right to know what kind of school is their child attending. So that's why we provide the capacity for anyone to find out the data for their school district. So the accompanying spreadsheets allow you to see that. You can also look at the trends over time, and you can look at it at the elementary level and the secondary level. And our web tool will soon have this data available, or most of it, where you can plug in the name of your district and not just get the data, but also see a graphic depiction of the suspension rates disaggregated by race and race and disability and race and gender. And we really need this information, again, because being suspended even once, for example, in ninth grade, we know from the research that we just published in the book, it correlates with a doubling of the dropout rate. That was based on a study in Florida that covered all ninth grade students and tracked them for over 6 years. We know from a study in Texas that tracked all the secondary students that being suspended out of school correlates highly with an increased risk for juvenile justice involvement and dropping out and grade retention and lower academic achievement. So it's really important that we think about what's going on in terms of the school climate, and these suspension rates are good indicators because we care about the academic impact. And so this is a starting point. This is the first time we've had data from every district in the nation, and we plan to continue when the next set of data are released so that we can continue to track these trends and answer the question, you know, are we closing the school discipline gap? So I'll now allow I invite Congressman Scott to provide some comments, and I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dan, and I want to thank you for walking us through the data, and want to thank you and the rest of UCLA Civil Rights Project, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the National Disabilities Rights Network for doing the hard work to go through the data. One of the things that we did right in 2001 when we were working on No Child Left Behind was the requirement that data be reported with disaggregated data, that is, with the subgroups, so that you could actually have the data to look at. And now most of the discussion of the data has been on the academic achievement gap. You're pointing out that there are other gaps, and the school discipline suspension is certainly one of them. You pointed out the high correlation between the suspension and dropping out, and there's also, we know from other research, high correlation of dropping out in the criminal justice system, and that's why the Children's Defense Fund is termed has used the phrase cradle to prison pipeline. When you have more suspensions, you're just adding to that pipeline. You've also pointed out the racial disparities. Now, we need this data. We needed the data so that we could actually get to the facts, what is actually going on, and the scope of what's going on. Once the data is available, it's nice for somebody to actually go through it as you have, so we actually know what's going on. But the fact of the matter is that none of the studies show that suspending children from school does anybody any good. The children, if they're behind when they get suspended, they're going to be behinder when they get back. That's obviously not helpful, and that leads, as you've indicated, to a higher probability of dropping out. We know that there are methods that can be used to discipline students if necessary that do not include suspension, that are more effective than suspensions. And then we need to work on those. And as you've indicated, several school systems have significantly reduced their suspensions as they have used these better techniques. And so now that the data is available and has been researched, it's up to members of Congress to use the information you're providing to try to encourage localities to use other discipline techniques that do not include suspensions, do not include actually encouraging or increasing the number of dropouts and all of the problems that that occur. And there's one issue that is frequently ignored, and that is services a student who's been suspended may be entitled to. We went through this with when we were reauthorizing Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, where disabled students were being kicked out with no services. We provided in that legislation that whatever the reason is for what, if you have to suspend a student, you still are obligated during the time of suspension to provide services. What they were doing is just kicking them out no services sooner, and in short order, the students would drop out. Well, that's not helping anybody. So as we discuss this, one of the issues will be the services that any suspended student may be entitled to, so that when they come back, they're not much further behind than they left and much more likely to drop out. So, Dan, thank you for all of your work, and thank you for going through it and providing members of Congress, as we are in the middle of reauthorizing the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, you've given us more work to do. So thank you very much, and I look forward to the questions.
Very good. And Janelle?
Thank you so much. My name is Janelle George, and I'm with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, or LDF. LDF is a civil rights organization founded by the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, and we are the organization that litigated the Brown versus Board of Education case. And for decades, we've really advocated for an end to achievement gaps and racial disparities, but also the promotion of equal educational opportunities. And I really just really want to point out, you know, in the conclusion of the report, they note, you know, our nation cannot close the achievement gap if we ignore the discipline gap. And I think that some folks interpret school discipline as a marginal issue or sideline issue, and we really just want to underscore that school discipline and how it undermines equal educational opportunity is central to student achievement and student outcomes. And this is very much a central civil rights issue. So I just really want to thank Dan Lowson and the others who worked on this report and this book, Congressman Bobby Scott, the ranking Democratic member on the House Education and the Workforce Committee, for his advocacy, as he noted, the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is moving rapidly through Congress, and also Diane Smith-Howard, who's on this call, for her advocacy work for students with disabilities. And again, we contextualize this as a central civil rights issue. The First Lady noted in an event on Friday that education is really the civil rights issue of our time. So we really just can't minimize the importance of addressing overly punitive discipline practices that push students out of school, such as suspensions or expulsions for minor misbehavior, and how that undermines outcomes. As Congressman Scott noted, these students are not receiving educational services, and I think that an earlier report noted that only 26 states are actually providing any kind of support for students who are suspended or expelled. So what happens is they disengage from learning and have a hard time catching up. So as a result, we see higher dropout rates and poorer academic outcomes. And the LDF has really worked as a federal liaison for the Dignity in Schools campaign, which is a coalition of 92 organizations from 23 states dedicated to ending the systemic, what we call school pushout, which is the result of these overly punitive practices that are pushing students out of school, and not only into the juvenile justice system, but also out onto the streets and into lower wage employment due to undermined academic outcomes. Recently, LDF and the National Women's Law Center issued a report on African American girls in education, and we really noted how these discipline disparities particularly impact young African American women and undermine their educational outcomes. And one key recommendation in our report was the need for data, and the data to be disaggregated by race, gender, and disability to give us a more clear picture of what's really happening with young African American girls. And this report is particularly notes that black females with disabilities are suspended at higher rates than white males with disabilities. That's a 22.5% compared to 16.2% of white males. And moreover, among students with disabilities, black females have higher suspension rates than white males at both the elementary and the secondary education levels. But without having this data disaggregated, We don't have that information, so we don't have a full picture that would enable us to really inform interventions and supports to help address some of these troubling trends. And African American girls are really uniquely positioned at the confluence of race and gender stereotypes. For instance, they're often disciplined for dress code violations, such as wearing their hair natural. In our report, we talked about the case of Tiana Parker, a 7-year-old African American student at a public charter school in Oklahoma who was sent home for a dress code violation because she had her hair, natural hair and locks, and told she was unpresentable by her school because of her dress code. So these are the kind of minor infractions that are frankly rooted in both race and gender stereotypes that are pushing young African American women out of school. And how these race and gender stereotypes play out really points to the need and the urgency of addressing implicit race and gender bias. And it's important to note that the story we tell of Tiana Parker, she was at a predominantly African-American charter school. So when we talk about implicit bias, we're not just talking about one race having stereotypes against another. It can be among a race having internalized stereotypes that play out in these discretionary discipline decisions. And I just want to close my remarks by highlighting Dr. Jamila Blake has a chapter in the book that elaborates and talks a little bit more about the confluence of race and gender stereotypes and how this is undermining African American girls' education. So I really just want to point to that and again underscore we cannot close achievement gaps if we don't close the school discipline gaps. And this is why it's important in the reauthorization of ESEA to hold schools accountable for collecting this data, and not as a means of sanctioning schools, but as a means of providing appropriate services and supports and interventions to address these troubling trends. So this means professional development training on implicit bias, cultural competency training, and trauma-informed responses. So that, for instance, young women who are the victims of bullying and harassment are not disciplined as aggressors, but supported and provided the services and needs that they have as victims of trauma. So thank you again so much for all of your work, and I just really hope that people will lift up the information in this report and use the tool, especially when the web-based tool becomes available, to really gather and disseminate this information.
Janelle, thank you very much, and let's turn now to Diane Smith-Howard.
Thank you, and I feel honored to be in such great company here today. I'm with National Disability Rights Network, which is the national membership organization of the protection and advocacy agencies. There's a PNA agency in every state that represents individuals with disabilities, and we are the nation's largest provider of representation for young people with disabilities who are being suspended and expelled from school. We handle hundreds of cases per year. And I'll just say from the outset that the report and the book that we're talking about here today have both provided tremendous tools for our network and for other advocates who do this work to address school-to-prison pipeline issues that arise. And one of the things that it allows, the combination of the book and the research together and the data, is that it allows the advocates to carefully target the scarce resources that we have so we can focus on the districts and the areas that need the most help and also provide research-based interventions. I think that the most important story that the data tells is about districts and what a difference it can make when a child moves from one district to another. And that some districts, even districts that don't have a lot of resources, can use research-based interventions and bring their discipline rates down, and how important that message is to get out. It confirms what we know anecdotally, that children with disabilities who particularly those who are members of more than one protected class, so particularly children who are children of color and also have disabilities, tend to be suspended and expelled from school at incredibly high rates. And another thing that we don't collect data on currently but is a concern for us is that as there is additional focus on suspension and expulsion data, some school districts in our experience are finding other creative ways to remove children from school so that they don't show up in the data. And so we're encouraging policymakers to look at how to collect data on these, what we're calling informal removals, kids who are sent home from school, who are placed out of school pending a risk assessment, and some of the other methods that school districts use to get around reporting the suspension and expulsion of children with disabilities. The significance of the district-level data is, it has been our experience within our network, and the data bears this out, that leadership and attitude make all the difference. And districts that really think of all the children in their district as their kids, including the children with disabilities, do a better job and are able to reduce the data, reduce the suspension and expulsion of these kids. And it is so interesting when you look at the list of, in the report, of improved districts. They are not wealthy districts. And you know that their improvement in their suspension expulsion rate has not been easy. And then you may look at districts nearby and see that that has not happened. And so I think that just tells a really important story. So from this, I think we would really like to make clear that right now, families of children with disabilities are the greatest enforcers of the IDEA and Section 504, which are the two federal statutes to protect young people with disabilities. And they have protections in them to make sure that children with disabilities are not suspended or expelled from school because of this behaviors related to their disabilities, and that instead they receive behavioral services and supports so that they can get a free and appropriate public education. We handle so many cases, and so do other advocates and attorneys in the field, where those services and supports were not provided, and as a result, children with disabilities are out of school. And when they are removed from school, not only does it impact them, but recent data has also shown that school climate and an increased amount of, or high level of suspension also impacts other children, that school climate impacts all the kids in the school, not just the children with disabilities who are being repeatedly suspended. So we have asked that the Department of Education and Department of Justice really focus on enforcing the violations of the law so that families do not have to be the primary enforcers of these laws. These families are not well suited for this, and nor is it really their responsibility to do so, and that districts be required to use available resources that we know address behavioral issues that children with disabilities do not need to be removed from school, and that districts, the local, state, and federal level, actually not just districts, use currently available data to structure systemic change within the geographic jurisdiction to improve suspension expulsion rates and increase the use of research-based practices. And then I really would like to tell you a very brief story of a young gentleman who was identified for special education at elementary school. He's an African-American child in the Detroit suburbs who has some behavioral disabilities and specific learning disabilities. His family was told in fourth grade that had they not been so intimately involved in his education, he would have been expelled for a variety of nonviolent issues related to his disability and clearly documented as such. He didn't even get an IEP or didn't become eligible for special education until the end of fifth grade, and they said that they did it at that point just to help him transition to middle school. His first suspension was in elementary school, and it was for taking a piece of candy out of the teacher's lounge, one single piece of candy. He got a week of suspension for that. After that, there were multiple suspensions, and by the time he was in eighth grade, he was being suspended every several weeks for nonviolent disability-related behavior. Eventually, the family didn't know what to do. They realized that they needed to do something because he was not going to be successful in high school, and they moved to a neighboring district. So a contiguous district to the one that he was in, a very similar economics, demographics, but what was different was the attitude. And the new district took all of his records, reviewed them, put together a positive behavior support plan for the young man. He continued on occasion to have disability-related nonviolent behaviors, but the attitude was different. And so when he got in trouble, they had a meeting and they figured out what to do. And at this point, he is 18 years old and he is on target to graduate from the Berkeley School District. And the family is just very pleased with the work that they have done with him. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Diane, thank you very much. Bobby Jean, let's get to Q&A here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Black. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please press star and the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We have a few questions. The first question comes from Emily. Last name is L-O-C-O-Z, and she's with the Claritin Ledger. Your line is live.
Great, thank you. I actually have a question about one of the numbers on the spreadsheets for Mississippi, and it's the one in secondary school. It's got the Hawaiian Pacific Islanders suspension rate at 216%, and I'm wondering if that's a typo or if that's actually accurate. It's just so huge.
So this is Dan Lawson. So in a couple cases, that should probably have some shading on it. I don't know if I'm not looking at it.
It doesn't, no.
But obviously that would be – there. Usually you'll see errors like that when the suspension rate, when the numbers of students is very low.
Yeah.
And so some of those may have slipped by, but for the most part we eliminated entire school districts where any suspension rate for any major racial or ethnic group was over 100%. The only time we would have left it in is if they made up a very tiny percentage of the total population, but it should have gotten a color coding to indicate the error, but it's obviously you can't suspend more kids than enroll.
Yeah.
Now, there are a few places like that, and you'll find that these data – you'll probably find something similar if you go to OCR's website and looked up the same school district for that subgroup. But
yeah, it's actually the state average.
Dan, can I ask a question on that? This
yeah.
is Bobby Scott. If one person gets suspended twice, is that once or twice?
It's only counted once, so that's why you should never see anything over 100%. But there's one exception to that. Occasionally, you'll see, usually again, with a very low enrollment of a subgroup, maybe there was a – because the enrollment data come from just one day and the suspension data are cumulative, you could have, let's say, on the one day of the enrollment, maybe there were 20 Native American students, but maybe over the course of the year, some moved in and some moved out, so there might have been 30 Native American students. And if you – suspended 21 of the 30, it would show up as over 100% because it only reflects the enrollment data from one day, and not it's not the cumulative. That's just the way the data are collected. There's not cumulative enrollment data, but that's pretty rare. So you know, for the most part, we cleaned out any districts where a major racial or ethnic group had a suspension rate over 100%. So you should almost never find that.
But the what I'm looking at isn't for a district, it's for the state. It's for the state of Mississippi. And when you so in the secondary school, like Mississippi, for secondary students, Mississippi has the fourth highest overall suspension rate. But if you look at just individual subcategories of students, it's pretty low. So I feel like this Hawaiian Pacific Islander 216% rate really boosted Mississippi's overall secondary suspension.
It couldn't have, because they're probably the enrollment of Hawaiian Pacific Islanders in Mississippi is a tiny fraction of the state's overall enrollment. So
okay.
This is not an average per racial group at all.
Okay.
So it would not have had almost any impact whatsoever on the state's suspension rate.
Great.
So I can find that. And, you know, we can also make adjustments by addressing that and color-coding it as an error.
Thank you.
Next question.
And our next question comes from the line of Amanda Paulson, the Christian Science. Your line is live.
Thank you, Christian Science Monitor. Thanks for doing this call, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about some of those districts that saw the most improvement over 2 years and a little bit about the types of interventions that have been shown to work and work much better and help them reduce those suspension rates.
Sure. So the data in the report and our analysis of the declines, we did not follow up with these specific districts, but we do hope members of the media do to get the story behind those declines. We do know, though, in the book that just came out, Closing the School Discipline Gap, does highlight effective changes in many districts around the country. One of the most effective and robust studies was done covering Denver public schools over a 6-year period, where they started with a pilot program of restorative practices and expanded it to a systemic district-wide program of intervention. And during that 6-year period, the suspension rates came down. They're still somewhat on the high side, or higher than we would like, but they reduced, for example, K-12, the black suspension rates went from about 17% to around 10%, and all the racial and ethnic groups had reductions, but none as large as the African-American population. So the racial gap got smaller. Suspension rates came down for all students and all subgroups. During that period, the achievement scores increased steadily for every racial group in every grade in every subject that was tested. So this is, you know, it really helps dispel this myth that somehow we have to kick out the quote-unquote bad kids so the good kids can learn. There also, we had a different report where we show in Los Angeles there's been suspension rates reductions and a narrowing of the racial gap over the last 2 years based on California's data. And there have been concerted efforts to address the overuse of suspension. There was actually a resolution agreement with the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights several years ago, as well as a lot of community groups, including CADRE and others that have worked with the district to address this issue. And there are many other examples. Cleveland, Ohio, in the chapter by David Osher in the new book, after a school shooting, first invested in school police and metal detectors, and then they turned instead to investing in a system of social-emotional learning, supports and training for teachers, having students sent to learning centers instead of being suspended out of school, a whole number of interventions, and where these were effectively implemented, they looked at each school, and where it was implemented with integrity, the sense of safety improved, and the suspension rates came down. So there was a lot of progress there, and there are many other examples in the new book of research that we just published.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Rick Carlin, Times Union. Your line is live.
Yeah, hi. This does include charter schools, is that correct?
Yes, all the charter schools. Now, some charter schools are schools within a district, and some are identified as individual districts. So, yes, it includes charter schools. But, for example, in Boston, there are several high-suspending charter schools, but they're independent districts, so they don't reflect upon the suspension rates for the Boston public schools. The public charter schools serving Boston students are listed separately.
Okay. Thanks.
The next question comes from Evie Bland, Education Week. Your line is live.
Yeah, I hear a lot in general about underreporting of discipline or about unreliable reporting to the feds at the district level, and I was wondering if you could talk about that generally, and also from the special ed perspective, what you were saying about alternative methods of classroom removal that aren't labeled as suspensions, if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure, and maybe I'll let Diane Smith answer the second part of the question. But in terms of the underreporting, you know, every school district chief administrator had to sign off on their data as being accurate and report it to a federal civil rights agency, the U.S. Department of Ed Office for Civil Rights. So there is some concern that in some districts they may have fudged the data a little bit, and we have no way to determine that. What we did do, though, is we may have missed a district or two, but we looked for large districts where they're reporting zero suspension rates to get some of the most obvious underreporting. And if that same district had reported to their state education agency or on their district website that they had suspended kids in the same year, then we would remove that district from the spreadsheet, and they would be found in the error files. But occasionally we also have seen districts who just didn't follow the instructions and reported the number of suspensions and not the number of students suspended at least once. And so occasionally you'll see numbers that are slightly inflated. And again, we took out the districts where we found a major racial or ethnic group was suspended at over 100%. And I'll have to look into what happened to Mississippi. But by and large, those were eliminated. So we eliminated some of the really high, the over 100%, as well as where we could find competing indication that the zeros were not accurate. And I think it's really important that if we have this data, part of what we are looking at is finding success and providing incentives for more accurate reporting to the public. That will help mitigate some of the concerns around inaccurate reporting. But I'll let Diane maybe answer the question about the other kinds of problems where kids are removed in other ways.
Sure. Just by way of context, I think there's two factors that lead to this use of informal removals. One is that if you're going to remove a child with a disability from school, the district is required to follow the disciplinary protections of IDEA and Section 504, which can be complicated. And also, now that districts are reporting data on suspension and expulsion and that data is being analyzed, there's a disincentive now to report that data. So those are my contextual comments on that. But what we're seeing within our network and also within the work of other advocates that represent kids with special ed needs is the increased use of informal methods of removal, which would be ways to remove a child from school because of disability-related behavior in a manner that doesn't go through the IDEA and 504 requirements. And so some of the ways that we've seen this happen are kids who are either put on a shortened school day for a long period of time where the district just informs the family that the child will go home at 11 o'clock, for example. 11 o'clock is a popular time. Or that the child is repeatedly sent home and the parent is called to come pick the child up over and over and over again. Or the child is transferred onto a homebound program where essentially the child is home all day and the parent is the primary teacher of that child. There are a number of different ways that happens. In addition, some people include in this conversation transfer to alternative schools that don't provide credit. But sort of ways to remove a child with a disability from school when the behavior would more properly be remediated with services and supports. And so one of the things that we would like to see happen is both better reporting, essentially right now there's almost no reporting of informal removals, but also additional resources for school districts to help them use the research-based interventions that we know work with kids with disabilities, so they're not put in a position where they are not sure what to do and just want to remove the child.
And one follow-up question about the accuracy of the data. When you say you remove districts that had more than 100% of a given group, is that because they inaccurately inputted the data or because of some error with statistical analysis or modeling?
No. I mean, you can see all the numbers that we have. And going back to Mississippi, there were only 30 Hawaiian Pacific Islanders enrolled in all of Mississippi,
uh-huh.
And 65 were suspended, so that should have been caught.
So that's a problem with how they inputted the data as opposed to how you analyzed it?
Right, that's
okay.
Correct. So you will find, for example, on OCR's website where you can look up the K-12 data, you will see similar errors that they didn't clean out any of the data that is published there. So We caught most of the mistakes, but not 100%. What we also do is provide, you know, the raw numbers. So you can scroll over and see the number of students suspended in that group and the number of students enrolled. These are just rounded to the nearest five, so it should never have created a situation where it was over 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so this is all, you know, done with the Excel spreadsheets. We had the researchers' data, which we imported onto the Excel format. So you will find, like I said, a lot more errors on the OCR website than you will find in our spreadsheet.
And one unrelated follow-up, sorry, I won't filibuster, but you talked about some places that had great improvements. When you look at states or districts that have really high suspension rates, have you seen any commonality of policies? Is there something that you've identified in Florida that has led, you know, to these higher rates, or is it just you think there's...
No, I think that, this report sort of begs the question. But we did not do a 50-state analysis of the different policies or practices. What we do highlight in the written part of the report around states is that we do know of some states, like in Connecticut, where legislation was passed to make suspensions strictly a measure of last resort, and they are on the sort of lower end of suspension rates. Similarly, Maryland has had a law in place for several years where if any school suspends more than 10% of their enrollment, it's required that there's some interventions such as positive behavioral interventions and supports that take place. Some of the newer changes are not yet reflected. For example, California, Governor Brown just signed into law a requirement that one of the leading suspension categories called disruption and willful defiance not be grounds for out-of-school suspension for any students in grades K through 3. I know advocates there were hoping to make that K-12, and that might happen over time. The state of Virginia, this is a chapter in our book, has instituted something called a threat assessment protocol, which they've now adopted across the state of Virginia, which addresses only those kids exhibiting actual threatening behavior, but it's among that small subgroup of offenses, it has dramatically reduced kids who are being suspended out of school because it helps school-level personnel distinguish between a real threat and one that is just, misstatement or, you know, a minor and not substantial threat, and so that students don't have to be kicked out of school every time they say something inappropriate. So there's quite a bit of movement in certain states, but it does beg the question in others, especially some of the higher suspending states, about what is going on, if there's a statewide policy or practice. Most of the research, and one of the important studies, and this dovetails on what Diane was talking about at the end of her comments, there's a study that's in the book by Russ Skiba that covers the state of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at the attitudes of principals around school discipline and found that after controlling for race and poverty, the biggest predictor of whether a school was high suspending or low suspending was the attitude of the principal. So those that were sort of parroting the zero tolerance and blaming kids and parents for the problems and wanting to kick out the quote-unquote bad kids, they not only had higher suspension rates, they also drove racial disparities. So those things went hand in hand. So I think that's really important that a lot of the changes that are effective happen at the district and the school level. In the book, we also interview Karen Webern-Dorr, who's in charge of, she's one of the leading administrators in Baltimore City, where they've made a lot of progress in this area. And she talks about training the principals in that district to address school climate in several ways, including looking at their discipline data, but also finding ways to make their schools warmer, friendlier, and more supportive of kids, and really with the goal of keeping more kids in and helping them be successful.
Take the next question.
Okay. Next question comes from Patrick O'Donnell, the Plain Dealer. Your line is live.
Good Thank you. So I have two questions for you. So a couple of folks have asked about what are the other strategies that schools can use instead of suspending kids. So you mentioned a few examples. Do you have a good source that can just list out a few of those things in language my neighbor will understand? And then secondarily, you just made reference to poverty as being a big predictor. What have you done in terms of looking at the poverty rates related to the suspension rates with these districts?
Well, so to the last question first, actually, after controlling for poverty, what we find the major predictor is the attitudes of the principals. So I think that was the point, that poverty isn't really nearly as big a predictor as folks might think it is. And it's really not okay to suspend more kids just, you know, who happen to be poor, because the impact on poor families can be devastating, where parents have to choose between risking losing their job and staying home from school, or with their suspended student, or leaving their child unsupervised in what might be a high crime neighborhood. I think I may have lost a thread on the rest of the question, but I think it's really important. In terms of lay person terms, there are several kinds of interventions. One of them that tends to be pretty effective at reducing suspension rates but hasn't been proven effective yet, to our satisfaction, about reducing racial disparities, you commonly hear of positive behavioral interventions and supports, PBIS, and that has been adopted in many states and schools and districts across the country and had some success. And it's a tiered, it's a strategy of providing positive support for all kids and then identifying kids who need more support. So it's what they call a tiered intervention strategy. But in lay terms, it's really identifying the kids who need more support to be successful socially, emotionally, behaviorally, and providing them with the needs, with their needs, so that they're not being kicked out of school. So that would be PBIS. I mentioned restorative practices. These are covered in the new book that we have. Social-emotional learning is another one, which is part of that is teaching students and training teachers to do this, to teach kids in conflict resolution and understanding their emotions and how to manage anger and those sorts of kinds of behavior, understanding their behavior and learning how to control it.
Dan, this is Bobby Scott again. I think the important point that needs to be made is there are effective ways of dealing with discipline, proactive, after the fact, that are effective and actually reduce crime, do not result in the higher dropout rates, much more effective, and you're not inflicting the harm that these suspensions do, because the harm is that once you're suspended, you're more likely to drop out with all the pathology that goes along with that. There are strategies that work, and I think that's the point that needs to be made.
Absolutely. And then there's some really sort of there's some approaches to school discipline that make no sense whatsoever, like suspending students for truancy, or if you're concerned about, you know, suspending kids on a dress code violation because you're worried about gang activity, when the leading, you've just dramatically increased the likelihood that that student will become gang involved by pushing them out of school, when, you know, you could have, there are a million ways to address a dress code violation that doesn't, rely upon removing the student from school, not letting them come to school.
We have time for maybe one more question.
Our next question comes from Joe Robinson, the Kansas City Star. Your line is live.
Yes, thank you. Good day to you. I, of course, particularly interested in what you found in Missouri. And I saw in the report that you were looking for explanations in policy or something, but give me some more comment on what you see in Missouri, particularly in St. Louis and Kansas City, and what do you think that means?
Yeah, it was, you know, we didn't expect to see that relationship, especially with the unrest there. And I think it's maybe emblematic of a problem within the larger community. I think it implicates concerns about racial bias, there's the tendency to have very harsh discipline in school districts where you see high racial, high concentrations of certain racial groups and poor kids. It's very disturbing. But also in Missouri, we did find there were many school districts that did not have high suspension rates for the black students enrolled in those districts. So even within the state, there was a wide distribution of suspension rates for the different racial groups there. So it really sort of suggests something about that. And we didn't really unpack it, but it's very troubling.
And again with St. Louis, you also mentioned Kansas City too, right? I mean St. Louis and Riverview Gardens and Normandy, yeah, over there, but then Kansas City public schools also.
Yeah, Missouri and Kansas City, Kansas also had fairly high suspension rates, if I recall. But yes, they were among the highest suspending districts in the state, and many of them had very high racial disparities. But again, we're getting at the unnecessary use of suspension, and most of the places where we see really high rates, the lion's share of these suspensions are for minor offenses. And remember, this is a point I should have made earlier, none of the data that you're looking at in these reports includes expulsions. So expulsions are usually reserved for kids who bring weapons or drugs or inflict serious harm. There's probably excessive use of expulsions as well, but none of these are for those most serious offenses that would get an expulsion. These are all just out-of-school suspensions.
Thank you, Dan. We've used up our hour, but Dan is going to be available this afternoon for interviews. If you have any other questions or want to talk to him, please shoot me an email or give me a call. My contact information is on the media advisory and on the press release. And so with that, I want to thank all of our participants today and wish everyone a good day. Bobby Jean, thank you.
Thank you. And that concludes our morning teleconference. You may disconnect your lines.
Thanks, everybody.